supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight.
Immigrants are welcome here, no hate, no fear. Immigrants are welcome here, no hate, no fear.
That's the sound of yet another pro-immigrant rally in Philadelphia today, the site of several demonstrations since the Trump administration's crackdown on undocumented immigrants and plans to defund so-called sanctuary cities like Philadelphia. Meanwhile, the U.S. Supreme Court has denied a petition from immigrant women held at a Berks County detention center. WHYY's Laura Benchoff joins us now from Berks County. And Laura, start with the backstory. Who are these women?
Hi, Dave. So these women are all from Central America. They all came to the U.S. and either presented themselves at the border or crossed the border illegally. When they encountered a federal immigration official, they requested asylum in the U.S. They basically said, it's unsafe in the countries that we live in, be it El Salvador or Honduras or Guatemala, and we believe that we qualify for refuge in the U.S. About 14 of the two dozen women who were named plaintiffs in the case have been held at an immigration detention center in Leesport, Pennsylvania, for the duration, which has been about 18 months now, a year and a half, while they've been waiting to see if the Supreme Court would take up this case.
Their asylum claim was already denied, and that decision was upheld by an immigration judge. So, Laura, what was the basis for their request for further review?
So these women with the American Civil Liberties Union representing them were arguing that under what's called the writ of habeas corpus, which is a very technical term for saying anyone who is detained or the U.S. government is trying to remove from the country has the right to be seen before an independent judge. It's a very old law. It's a very basic sort of bedrock principle in the U.S. Constitution. And the American Civil Liberties Union was asserting on behalf of these women that they didn't get that review, they didn't get that right, and that their cases should be heard by an independent judge.
And as such, what was the Supreme Court's reasoning?
So the Supreme Court doesn't give reasoning when they decline to hear a case. They basically just file a one-line denial, which means that whatever the previous decision was by the lower appeals court, that just simply stands. And the appeals court's reason for their denial of the appeal was that these women are not subject to this right, that the federal government and the executive branch they do have the power to exclude women in this situation without review by a judge.
Supreme Court reasoning or not, I suspect there's been plenty of reaction.
Yes, there has been. And this case actually did get quite a bit of attention sort of as it was winding its way through the appeals courts, including some attention from scholars, constitutional scholars, and people who are experts in this specific law. And I actually spoke to one of those scholars earlier today. His name is Jonathan Hafitz, and he had this reaction.
Well, I think the ruling is a dangerous precedent because it opens the door to abuse by immigration authorities, and I think it undermines basic protections of all persons in the United States to habeas corpus and basic constitutional rights. I think it's a step away from, or it's a retreat from basically respecting all, human rights in the United States.
So that's what some constitutional lawyers are afraid of. But for the women themselves, this is not abstract at all. This was a really big disappointment. And I spoke to some of their lawyers who are based out in Berks County today who met with them and talked through their options with them. And, they said a lot of the women were crying. A lot of them were very disappointed because they have been held for so long with sort of the idea that they would be vindicated in some way. And their cases were selected to be included in this kind of constitutional test case because their lawyers believe that they do have asylum claims to be here, and they believe that something went wrong in their hearing that justifies them staying in this country legally. So they're obviously very upset.
So, Laura, as you've cited, these women and their children have been detained for some 18 months. What happens to them next now that the Supreme Court has denied their petition?
Well, their cases were kind of in limbo until the Supreme Court made a decision. So now that their case has been denied, their attorneys are filing for other forms of relief that they may be eligible for. Some of the children in the detention center have qualified for status during the time that they've been here, so they have a legal path to a green card. But in the other cases, it's basically up to immigration officials if they are going to allow these women to have their cases reheard or if they're going to try to deport them.
Thanks, Laura.
Thank you, Dave.
WHYY's Laura Benchoff reporting. And this note, immigration and customs enforcement officials did not return calls for comment. An Allentown, Pennsylvania teen with a famous grandfather is one of several young people suing the federal government for inaction on climate change. The suit, originally filed during the Obama administration, now faces a battle with President Donald Trump. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports.
Hello, my name is Sophie Kivlahan.
18-year-old Sophie Kivlahan says she doesn't remember when she first heard about climate change. It was a normal topic of conversation at the dinner table. That often included her grandfather, Jim Hansen, an astrophysicist at Columbia University and perhaps one of the world's most well-known climate scientists. He began sounding the alarm about rising temperatures and rising sea levels back in the early 1980s.
Because we concluded already that, oh, if we burn all the coal, we've got a different planet. We will lose all the coastal cities. It doesn't make sense to burn all the fossil fuels. We need to look at energy policies now.
But more than 35 years after Hansen published his first paper on climate change, he says the U.S. government has failed to act, and it's time for the courts to force the issue. His granddaughter, Sophie Kivlahan, agrees.
That legislative and the executive branch, when they both don't do their jobs, it's the court's jobs to act as a check.
The plaintiffs say the case could now be more successful with President Trump as an adversary. That's because Trump has reversed efforts made by the Obama administration to cut carbon emissions. And the Trump administration has been very outspoken about not addressing climate change issues, even though the science on it is settled. Hansen points to the success of civil rights lawsuits as a model.
There were lawsuits in the 1950s and 1960s against governments for violating the constitutional rights of equal protection of the laws and due process. And so this is somewhat analogous to that.
The analogy, say the plaintiffs, is young people. 21 kids from across the country are suing the federal government. They argue constitutional issues like due process, meaning their future rights to life, liberty, and property are threatened. Because although the government knows burning fossil fuels causes climate change, it continues to allow the practice. The lawsuit demands a plan to reduce atmospheric CO2 to safe levels by the year 2100. When asked what fears she has about her future, Sophie Kivlahan didn't paint a scary picture about rising seas and severe weather.
My greatest fear is that this will be my 24/7 job.
Kivlahan says she's not directly impacted by climate change right now, but that her dreams could be overshadowed by trying to solve a problem she didn't create. Instead, she really wants to be an obstetrician.
And I won't be able to do that, have my own life, my own family, have my own garden in my backyard, and have a dog.
The lawsuit also makes arguments based on a concept not in the Constitution. It's known as the public trust doctrine. Kivlahan says the government is responsible for maintaining a healthy atmosphere for future generations. Legal experts are divided on the case's likely outcome. Over the Obama administration's objections, a federal judge ruled it should go to trial. The Trump administration is fighting hard to prevent that. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
It's something advocates for homeless young people have known for a long time. Those most vulnerable are often targeted by human traffickers. Now, a major new survey of some 1,000 homeless youth in Philadelphia and 12 other cities found nearly 20% of them were forced to work or sell their bodies. WHYY's Katie Culinary reports.
Researchers at the University of Pennsylvania surveyed homeless young people in three of the 13 cities, including Philadelphia. And in Philadelphia alone, they found 18% had been trafficked for sex. Lead researcher Deborah Schilling-Wolf says while that figure is striking, it doesn't give the full picture. She says those surveyed were getting help at the nonprofit Covenant House shelter, leaving out many young people who were still on the streets.
We had the first prosecution in Philadelphia of a hotel that was harboring a young person who was being sex trafficked. That person wouldn't have been in our study. So we know that the numbers are out there, but we don't know how great they are, what the extent is.
Wolf says most of the young people said they dropped out of high school and had been sexually abused as children.
As one of the young people said to us, I was sexually abused as a child. So it just was normalized for me that other people could touch my body whenever they wanted to.
Researchers and advocates, including John Dukoff, who runs Covenant House of Pennsylvania, want to use this survey to make the case for new policies and more funding to give homeless young people safe places to stay.
There are thousands of homeless young people in the city of Philadelphia. We have to build a system that can serve and accommodate all of them.
Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
For years, corrupt Puerto Rico officials have been sending heroin addicts to bogus treatment programs in Philadelphia. Once they arrive, they find themselves in illegitimate recovery houses that profit from their addictions. This system is known as the Air Bridge, and one Pennsylvania state lawmaker has a new proposal for combating the problem. Joel Wolfram reports from WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk.
Many Airbridge victims find themselves in overcrowded recovery houses in State Representative Angel Cruz's district. Those running the houses cash in on residents' food stamps and sometimes collect those benefits even after the person has moved out of the home. In response, Cruz has introduced a measure aimed at preventing the swindlers from profiting from the public benefits system. Cruz says the bill calls for the government to monitor people who act as the payees of these benefits. That would be the recovery house operators who are receiving them on behalf of residents.
If you're going to be the payee, you're going to be visited by the Department of Welfare every 3 months to make sure that you have the person, that the person's getting treatment, that the person is not being abused, and then you can continue getting your benefits. If not, they're going to terminate your benefits.
But some are skeptical that Cruz's bill would make a difference. Jose Benitez is the executive director of the addiction services provider Prevention Point, which has helped many Airbridge victims. He says the law would only work if the recovery houses actually were appointed as the payees for food stamp benefits.
But that's not the way it goes down. It's you're the individual, and then you give us your access card, and we use it.
He explains that the houses will take benefit cards from people, but the victims are still the payees, the ones on record as receiving benefits. So Benitez says the Department of Welfare wouldn't know who to monitor. There's also no regulation of recovery houses, which would make any monitoring program more difficult. Cruz says his legislation is just one step towards stopping Airbridge and that more initiatives are needed at all levels of government. For WHYY, I'm Joel Wolfram.
As Philadelphia District Attorney Seth Williams faces corruption charges, seven Democrats and one Republican are vying to take his spot as the city's top prosecutor. But Newsworks commentator Solomon Jones writes that whoever takes over the post may not represent the will of the city's largest demographic.
Sometimes I feel as if freedom is slowly slipping away from African Americans, not because someone is violently attempting to take it from us, but because of voter apathy. I felt our freedom slipping away after the presidential election, when the winning candidate thanked blacks for not coming out to vote. I felt it slipping away in the last mayoral primary, when Democrat Jim Kenney won with only 27% of eligible voters casting ballots. But perhaps most troubling, I feel our freedom slipping away now. Today is the final day to register to vote in the May 16th Pennsylvania primary. That election will likely decide Philadelphia's next district attorney, and if blacks don't participate, apathy will win again, and black voters will have no one to blame but ourselves. Because blacks are more likely to be arrested than our white counterparts, even when the records and offenses are similar, we must vote. Because we are more likely to be convicted than whites, we must vote. Because we face longer sentences than whites, we must vote. But in Philadelphia, where poverty is concentrated in black and Latino communities, there are even more issues. Blacks who are too poor to afford lawyers are often represented by overburdened public defenders. At other times, impoverished blacks get court-appointed attorneys who take the money and run. But perhaps the most insidious racial inequity at the root of our criminal justice system is high bail. When people are charged with crimes in Philadelphia, they are often imprisoned in municipal jails for many months simply because they are too poor to pay the bail. A district attorney who understands the racial and economic disparities in the system could help to solve that problem by using the prosecutorial discretion that comes with the office. A community-focused DA would work to assure that black defendants are not overcharged, seek pretrial alternatives outside county prisons, and seek to use the office to uplift Philadelphians. We need a community-focused DA, and it's up to us to get one. The black community cannot afford to vote for a DA because established politicians endorse him or because he has the glossiest commercials, and given the Fraternal Order of Police's animosity toward the movement to stop police from killing unarmed blacks, African Americans must look warily at anyone the FOP endorses. This is no time for politics as usual. The DA's office is too important to our community, and the stakes are too high for our children. African Americans must not stay home on May 16th and watch someone else choose the city's top law enforcement officer. If we do, we will have lost just a little more freedom, and we'll have no one to blame but ourselves. I'm Solomon Jones.
Solomon Jones writes the Philadelphia Experiment blog at newsworks.org. Science will take center stage Saturday in marches planned across the country. Let's preview plans in Philadelphia with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Now, Derek, this also coincides with Earth Day Saturday. What's the intent behind this national march for science?
The intent of this is to bring awareness to people about the importance of science, given what the political climate is these days and what one could interpret as an assault on science in many ways. You know, the idea that people in government, in politics, contest the fact that global warming and climate change is indeed happening is frankly offensive to scientists, considering what the work is that scientists do. And so, rather than allow politics to hijack science and to spread some sense among the general population that science can be sidelined simply because one chooses to say that something isn't true without evidence or fact or real basis, is part of the effort of the march, is to have people more clearly and better understand the importance of science, a little bit more about how science works, and the reason why scientists use science the way they do.
The Philadelphia March will go from City Hall to Penn's Landing. Is it just for scientists or citizen scientists as well?
This is for everybody. We often take it for granted or ignore that science is a major factor in our lives or improving our lives every day. And the more we know and understand about science and how it can be used to our benefit, the better off we all can be.
Of course, by Saturday, the Philadelphia Annual Science Festival will be underway.
Yes, it begins this Friday. There are 80-plus free or nearly free activities and programs all over the city. There's something for everyone. And to me, that's another one of the major benefits about this program, the Science Festival, is that you get exposure to so many different kinds of science that are happening here in Philadelphia. You know, I love the city. We often recognize Philadelphia as a sports city, but I think we should take some time out to recognize Philadelphia and the surrounding region as a science city. There's so much science going on here. It's amazing. If you looked at it and clearly understood it, you'd actually go for Philadelphia more so as a science city because, as I often say, science never loses.
Of course, meteorological science has not advanced to the point yet where we have a reliable forecast for a week from Friday. But if the skies cooperate,
we'll do the best we can with the citywide astronomy night that happens on Friday, April 28th. This is a really wonderful event in which We will have telescopes placed at 24 locations around the city, in neighborhoods, at community centers, at schools, all around, so that folks in those neighborhoods and surrounding neighborhoods can come out and have a really great experience observing the night sky through really nice telescopes. Now, the telescopes and the expertise is being provided by the local area astronomy clubs. You don't have to go to a special location to do this. You don't have to go to the big building downtown. Science is right where you live. So we take the telescopes out to the neighborhood locations, and folks can see the science right above their heads. We know there are going to be some great sights because Jupiter is going to be available in the evening sky for all to see. The king of the planets looks great in a telescope.
I'm going to put you on the spot. You listed some 80 events over the course of the festival. If you only have the wherewithal, the time, the energy for just a couple.
I can't do that, but I can suggest you go to the Science Festival website and you can pick and choose among your favorites that you might like to enjoy.
Now, you just cited Jupiter. Is that your favorite?
Jupiter does look great. It's in a perfect position because it's now what's called opposition. That means it rises just about at sunset and sets at sunrise, so it's visible all night long. Mars is now sinking in the west. You can just catch it after sunset for maybe 40 minutes or so. But Saturn now rises after midnight, a few hours after midnight, and it's best seen in the pre-dawn sky between 5 and 5:30 a.m. down in the southern portion of the sky.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.